Welcome to the debate. Today we are performing, well, an autopsy on the engine of the modern world. We're looking at a conflict so pervasive that it's often invisible just because we are swimming in it. It is the structural collision between the global economic order and the biological requirements of life itself. We're drawing from the extensive work of John McMurtry and his colleagues in the Encyclopedia of Life Support Systems, specifically their analysis of philosophy and world problems. And I'll be arguing from the perspective of what the text calls the life ground, which suggests our current system is fundamentally life blind.
And I will be taking the perspective of standard economic rationality. And it is a heavy topic to start the day. Usually when we talk about the system, we're discussing interest rates, supply chains, or maybe wealth inequality. But the material we are covering today goes much, much deeper. It suggests that our economic system isn't just inefficient or unfair, but that it is actually a pathology.
Yeah, that is the core claim. The argument is that the dominant global system, capitalism, the market economy, whatever label you prefer, is structurally life blind. It argues that we have built a machine programmed to devour its own life support systems, not by accident, mind you, but by design.
Which is a massive accusation. I mean, as someone who tends to see the market as the greatest engine for prosperity and freedom in human history, I read this material with a lot of skepticism. It feels like it wants to replace human choice with a biological imperative. It frames the market as a disease rather than a tool.
But is it a choice if the result is extinction? That's the question we have to wrestle with here. So let's start with the foundation of the argument. It's about the decoupling of value from life. The source material argues that Western philosophy and economics have suffered this fatal split. They've severed the connection between what is valuable and what actually sustains existence.
Okay, so how does McMurtry define value then? Because in economics, value is subjective. It is what someone is willing to pay.
Right, and that is exactly what he critiques. He introduces what he calls the primary axiom of value. It's deceptively simple. X is good if and only if it enables, preserves, or deepens life. And X is bad if it disables or destroys it. This is the life ground. Everything, every law, every purchase, every investment should be judged against this absolute standard.
On the surface, I really can't disagree with that. I mean, who wants to destroy life? But as an economic principle, it's incredibly slippery. Deepening life is a vague concept. Does deepening life mean universal healthcare, or does it mean me buying a nice bottle of wine to enjoy my evening? Does it mean protecting a wetland or building a factory that employs 1,000 people so they can feed their families? Who gets to decide?
Well, the text argues that we don't need a dictator to decide because biology decides. We know what clean water is. We know what a breathable atmosphere is. We know what cognitive development in a child looks like. These aren't opinions. They are biophysical requirements. The problem is that our current system, what the text calls the money sequence of value, ignores these biological absolutes entirely.
You're talking about the formula here.
Exactly. The formula of global capitalism, M to C to M prime.
Right. Money is invested in a commodity to produce more money.
But look closely at the syntax of that equation. Money is the beginning and the end. Money is the subject. The commodity, which could be food, housing, weapons, or toxic waste processing, is just the middle step. It is a means to an end. The goal isn't better housing or more food. The goal is M prime, more money.
But hold on, that is just a description of investment. That is how we efficiently allocate resources. If I invest money to build a house, I expect a return. In the process, a family gets a house. Everyone wins. The money sequence is just a signal mechanism to tell us where to build. If people need houses, the price goes up. Investors see a chance for M prime, and they build houses. It is a virtuous cycle.
In a healthy system where money is a tool, the sequence is C to M to C. You have a commodity, like your labor, you sell it for money to buy another commodity, like bread. The goal is life. But the text argues that the global system has flipped this. It has become pathological. It has decoupled from the life ground. Think about it. If I can make M prime more money by destroying a rainforest, the system registers that as good. If I can make M prime by getting teenagers addicted to vaping,
The system registers that as growth.
Yeah, but
the system has no internal sensor to distinguish between a commodity that sustains life and one that kills it. As long as the money grows, the machine just hums along.
Okay, but that is why we have regulations. That is why we have laws. The market is an engine. You don't blame the engine for where the car goes. You steer it. You are treating the market like a moral agent. It's not. It is a calculator.
But what if the engine is eating the steering wheel? That's the issue here. The text makes a really disturbing comparison. It compares the M to C to M prime sequence to a cancer.
I found that analogy to be pretty aggressive, honestly. It seems designed to provoke rather than explain.
Look at the biology of it. What is cancer? It is a cellular sequence that replicates without an internal limiting principle. It grows purely for the sake of growth, and it eventually destroys the host that sustains it. The text argues that money capital behaves exactly like that. It demands infinite compound interest, infinite growth in a finite biosphere. It's not just neutral, as you say. It is aggressively invasive. It colonizes every aspect of life, our time, our attention, our environment, and converts it into money.
I think that is a category error. Cancer is a disease. The economy is a collection of human choices. When you call the system cancerous, you are effectively calling human desire cancerous. Because who is buying these things? We are. The market is just a mirror. If we want carbon-emitting cars, the market gives them to us. If we want cheap plastic, we get cheap plastic. You cannot blame the mirror for your ugly reflection.
That is the standard defense, right? Consumer sovereignty. The idea that the consumer is king. But are we really free to choose? Or is that freedom an illusion maintained by the sequence itself?
I would argue yes, we are free. And this is where I worry about the life ground theory. If we start saying that the system knows what is good for you better than you know what is good for you, we are stepping onto a very authoritarian road. The text critiques desire theory, the idea that value is just getting what you want. But isn't desire the spark of innovation? Isn't the freedom to pursue your own version of happiness the whole point of modern civilization?
But the text forces us to ask, is that internal life truly yours? Or has it been colonized?
Colonized by what? By commercials?
By the money sequence, the text introduces the concept of the consumer as pleasure machine. The system doesn't treat you as a complex human being with spiritual, intellectual, and social potential. It treats you as a sensory input-output node. It spends billions of dollars to manufacture desires in you that didn't exist before.
That is marketing. It's annoying, it's pervasive, but it is not mind control. I can turn off the TV.
Can you? Look at addiction. The text specifically highlights this. If you are addicted to opioids or gambling, the money sequence loves you. You are a highly reliable source of M prime. From the perspective of standard economics, satisfying your addiction generates utility. It adds to the GDP. But from the perspective of the primary axiom, the life ground, that transaction is pure negative value. It is disabling life. The market lacks a vocabulary to say no to profitable death.
I agree that addiction is bad. Nobody is arguing that heroin addiction is a social good, but where do you draw the line? If I like eating greasy burgers, that is bad for my biological life, technically. Should the life ground police stop me from eating a cheeseburger? Because once you start down that path, you end up with a state that dictates your diet, your hobbies, and your risks.
It is not about policing the individual burger. It's about the structural orientation of society. Right now, we subsidize the bad food and make the healthy food expensive. We design cities for cars, which generate gas sales, insurance sales, repair bills, all M prime, instead of for walking, which generates health, but very little money. The text isn't saying you can't have a burger. It is saying we have created a life-blind infrastructure that makes healthy living almost impossible for the average person, because it is not the most profitable path.
So let's talk about that infrastructure. Because the text offers an alternative structure, or rather, points out one that already exists. It uses a term I actually really liked, the civil commons.
Yes, this is the hero of the story, in a way.
Define it for us, because it sounds like government, but the author seems to think it is something more ancient, more fundamental.
The civil commons is described as humanity's social immune system. It is every rule, every shared space, every regulation that has evolved to protect the community from destruction. It's the Village Well. It's the public library. It's the universal healthcare system. It's the Clean Air Act. It is even language itself. These are things that are accessible to all, not based on your ability to pay, but based on your need as a living being.
Sure. And I am a big fan of libraries and clean air. Civil society is essential. But the text sets up this war between corporate personhood and the civil commons that I think is a bit melodramatic. It frames them as mortal enemies.
Is it melodrama? Look at what happens when the money sequence enters the civil commons. It tries to privatize it. It tries to enclose it.
But sometimes privatization is the best way to save a resource. We know the tragedy of the commons. If everyone owns it, no one takes care of it. If you put a price on water, people stop wasting it. If you privatize a service, you often get efficiency, innovation, better technology. The civil commons can be stagnant. Bureaucracies are slow. The market is dynamic.
But at what cost? The text references the Lockean proviso. Even John Locke, the father of property rights, said that you can only appropriate nature if there is enough and is good left for others.
Right, the sufficiency condition.
Exactly. The money sequence violates that systematically. When you privatize the water supply, you aren't just managing it. You are turning a life necessity into a vehicle for profit. You are extracting value from people's survival. If you can't pay, you don't drink. That is the definition of life blind. The text argues that corporate personhood is an entity designed to strip mine the civil commons.
Strip mine is a loaded word. Corporations also pay the taxes that build the civil commons. They invent the medicines that extend life. They build the infrastructure. You cannot just look at the extraction side.
They do, but let's look at the legal structure. A corporation has the rights of a person. It can sue. It can own property. It has free speech. But it has none of the biological vulnerabilities. It cannot be poisoned. It cannot get cancer. It has no conscience to prick. So when this person competes against actual biological humans, the humans lose. The corporation can wait out any lawsuit. It can move its pollution to a jurisdiction with weaker laws. It is an invasive species in the ecosystem of rights. It systematically dismantles the protections that the civil commons built.
I will concede this, the lack of accountability for externalities, like pollution, is a flaw in the current market model. We need a referee. If a corporation poisons a river, it should absolutely pay for it.
But the text argues that paying for it isn't enough. You can't pay for a dead river. You can't pay for a disrupted climate. The damage is often irreversible. This is why the money sequence is dangerous. It thinks everything is exchangeable. It thinks if you destroy X, you can just replace it with Y amount of money. But life does not work that way.
This leads us to the section on justice, which I found the most controversial. The text basically throws out modern theories of justice, specifically Rawls and the Pareto Principle.
Yes, because they are life blind.
Which I found audacious. The Pareto Principle is logical bedrock. It says a change is efficient if at least one person is better off and no one is worse off. How can you argue with that? It is the definition of a victimless improvement because it focuses on income and goods, not life conditions. Suppose a factory opens in a town. The owner gets rich, huge M prime. The workers get a slightly higher wage than they did before. According to Pareto, everyone is better off, or at least not worse off financially. So the economist says, great, efficiency achieved.
And why isn't it? The workers have more money? The owner has more money.
But what if that factory pumps carcinogens into the water supply? What if the noise pollution increases stress levels for the whole town? The Pareto Principle doesn't capture that unless you explicitly price it in, which we rarely do. The text argues that theories like Rawls' Difference Principle, which accepts inequality as long as the poor benefit slightly, are dangerous. They justify a world where the rich get private jets and the poor get a slightly better smartphone, while the planet burns around both of them. So what is the alternative if we throw out Pareto and we throw out market utility? What are we left with? The text keeps coming back to this life value calculus, but I still don't see how you operationalize it without a massive bureaucracy telling people how to live. Sorry, you can't buy that car. It doesn't align with the primary axiom. Sorry, you can't build that factory. It sounds like a command economy.
It is not about a command economy. It's about a gestalt shift. It is about changing the fundamental metric of success. Currently, our metric is GDP, the total speed of the money sequence. If there is a massive oil spill and we spend billions cleaning it up, GDP goes up. The system cheers.
The LifeGround perspective says no, that is a loss.
I agree, GDP is a flawed metric. Even its inventor said so.
So the alternative is to measure life capital. We measure the health of the soil, the literacy of the children, the purity of the air, the stability of the climate. And we make economic decisions based on maximizing those assets, not maximizing the pile of money.
That sounds nice, but what does that mean for policy?
It means we stop subsidizing the things that kill us. Currently, public money pours into fossil fuels, industrial agriculture, and war. Those are all M-prime generators that destroy life. A life-value economy would shift those resources into the civil commons, education, preventative health, environmental restoration. It defines efficiency not as most money created, but as least life wasted.
I can see the appeal of that, but I worry that it ignores the complexity of human motivation. People don't just want life support. They want adventure, status, luxury, novelty. The money sequence, for all its flaws, caters to those desires incredibly well. If you switch to a life-ground economy, do we lose the vibrancy? Do we just become healthy, bored cattle in a safe pen?
That is a cynical view of life. The text argues that the money sequence is what makes us cattle, chewing on the cud of consumerism. True life value includes art, philosophy, connection, play, discovery. Those are things that deepen life. The current system often suppresses those things because they aren't profitable. You don't need to buy anything to have a deep conversation or walk in the woods.
Touché. I suppose the market does try to monetize those things, often ruining them in the process.
Exactly. The text calls for the life coherence principle. Rationality must be consistent with the conditions of its own existence.
I like that phrase. Rationality must be consistent with the conditions of its own existence. It is a very logical closing argument, because if you are so smart that you destroy your own food supply, you aren't actually smart. You are an evolutionary dead end.
Precisely. If your economic model leads to the extinction of the economist, the model is wrong. It doesn't matter how much math you have to back it up.
I can meet you there. I think where I still diverge is the mechanism. I believe the price signal, the market, is still the best tool we have to solve these problems if we can price in the damage. Carbon taxes, pollution costs. Make the bad things expensive, but don't throw out the mechanism of choice. Don't throw out the open range of human liberty.
And I think the text would argue that pricing in the death of the biosphere is impossible because life is not a commodity. It has infinite value, not a market price. You cannot put a price tag on the preconditions of life itself.
That is the fundamental tension, isn't it? Is life priceless, or does everything have a price?
It brings us back to that primary axiom. When you make a decision, an investment, a purchase, a vote, ask yourself, does this deepen life, or does it just feed the money sequence?
It is a heavy question. It forces you to look at your own wallet and your own habits with a much more critical eye. It suggests that every dollar is a vote for what kind of world we want to live in. And I think there's a lot more to explore in this material on how we actually get there.
It does. We are living inside the machine. But maybe we don't have to be parts of it. We can choose to align with the life ground.
A provocative thought to end on, and one that I'll be thinking about the next time I check my stock portfolio.
Thanks for listening to The Debate.
See you next time.